as far back as you want to go in history in terms of philosophers, what philosophy is as a field and where we get it as people who come from Western cultures and have a strong heritage linked to Europe. In terms of where we go next with this discussion, I think we need to go back to what I was hoping to do earlier in the show, which is go back to the classical Greek thinkers of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and how their ideas have been applied by modern and, of course, pre-modern, medieval, and everyone who followed after them. How have their ideas influenced philosophy as a whole?
It's one thing to say how have they influenced things. It's another thing to say how they kind of got things kick-started, really. I mean, one reading of those three is really that they get the whole ball rolling. Of course, there's the pre-Socratics, but we'll talk about Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle's influence. Each of their influences is going to be a little bit different. I mean, for as much as they get grouped together, they are very distinct individuals, and it's oftentimes because of the occurrence of Socrates in Plato's dialogues. I find that they can, in the general conception of things, be kind of blurred together, but they are quite distinct. Plato held ideas that Socrates probably didn't hold. We only have evidence for Socrates having a method. He claimed not to have any ideas of his own. He just went around talking to people and engaging in dialogue, as we've said, after embarking on what was ultimately a divine mission. The Oracle of Delphi kind of set Socrates on this goal of trying to prove them wrong. I don't know. That seems to be what he says in his account in Plato's Apology, that there's no way that I'm the wisest, or there's no one wiser than me. And I'm saying this like I kind of presuppose a bit about what the listener understands of Socrates, that he went about and asked his fellow Athenians various questions in order to try and disprove this claim. But essentially, the influence of Socrates, because that's what we want to talk about, I'm kind of rambling, the influence of Socrates was more or less that I don't want to say that he gets Plato started, but that is, in terms of the history of philosophy, he gives Plato a very effective method of engaging with each other, arguably with ourselves, through dialogue, through the inquiry of going through a sort of process of, it is called elenchus, of basically cornering each other into having to admit, oh yeah, we're kind of wrong about this, and then having to give alternate answers to it. And that is productive of new ideas. That's kind of how Socrates proceeded. I'm sure there's so much more to say about Socrates. People have been talking about Socrates since forever, but
I mean, it's important, as Brandon said, Socrates was on a very particular mission, and that mission was to basically kickstart our understanding of epistemology, or the theory of knowledge, right? By attaining and trying to help people uncover why they held such positions, right? So when Socrates' friend comes to him and says, Socrates, guess what? The oracle said you were the wisest man in all of Athens. Socrates goes, nah, that can't be true because I know nothing anyway. And so he goes around and he starts, he starts investigating. He starts going to the people he thought for sure would have an answer. So the sophists, he's famous for his discourse with the sophists, right? That that were trained in rhetoric. They advertised, we will help you win an argument. We will help you make your weak position the stronger one. To which the sophists kind of suck because Socrates just destroys them all and causes the young men of Athens to laugh. And this stirs up political unrest to the point where they want to kill Socrates. They want to get rid of this guy that's making them look like abject, rational garbage. But what Socrates does for the course of Western philosophy is he first of all gets that discussion of how do we know things and why do we know them going. And then he goes on to, or Plato inserts this, we're not entirely sure, because obviously, guess what, guys? Socrates never wrote anything down. He was quite critical of people who would write things down because, as one of my professors shared with us, he saw that was basically the death of that knowledge, the death of that discourse, because to uncover knowledge was to be in dialogue with another person. It wasn't just to be like, okay, here's what I know, pass this around, assimilate it. It was actually, no, it's an act of discovery. So we have that. We have, of course, the idea of the Platonic forms, right? That there is some definition of everything in the world that we perceive that we cannot fully understand because we are human and material. We can understand the particulars, but we can't understand the overarching truest sense of what a human is or what a dog is or whatever. So there's all these questions he throws out. There's all these concepts that are created. And one final point is, I understand where my colleague Brandon is coming from in the terms that they have very distinct ideas and therefore should not necessarily, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle should not necessarily be lumped together. However, that was just the nature of their relationship. It was Socrates who drew Plato in, called Plato to himself. Plato was a sad, lonely playwright and poet before Socrates came along. And Socrates was like, come on, boy, we're going to go on an adventure. And then Plato got old and Socrates died and trained up Aristotle. And where the break technically occurs is Socrates leaves the school of Athens to Plato. So where all this good dialogue had been happening, Plato is now the bigwig. Except now Plato's dying, and he has two disciples. And Aristotle is pretty sure that, you know, I'm Plato's favorite, so he's gonna choose me. Well, that didn't happen. And that made, I would assume on a human level, Socrates a little, Socrates is dead. Aristotle a little jaded. So he definitely takes some more radical positions, one of which is the question of whether Aristotle just took the Platonic forms and internalized them into his method of categories. And so maybe one day if I pick up a show on Aristotle, I'll go into more of what that is. But the three central questions being what is knowledge? How do we discover that? And then how does that affect our lives is kind of the key focuses of Plato's work.
Why do we care? Because there are so many things that happen in history that are lost to history that no one ever hears about. And so why do we care about Socrates? Why do we even know that he existed? And that's because he lived a very dramatic life. He dedicated himself to discussions in which he wanted to better his own knowledge, but he wanted to do that in a way that he bettered the knowledge of the person he was talking to as well. That essentially they would explore a topic together and come out of it with both of them with better knowledge than they went into it. And so that method, which is fundamentally a social method, not a method of writing things down, it's not a method like the scientific method of observation where you can do it on your own. Philosophy is fundamentally a social practice, or at least it was for Socrates. And then, well, Socrates does this essentially too much. He's too successful. He's eroding the social fabric of the city of Athens, which, permit me to remind our listeners, is the city dedicated to the Greek god of reason, who, if you've familiar at all with the Odyssey, reason in the Greek context is really a lot more like cunning and trickery than it is like high-minded, good faith discussion that we think of reason today. So essentially, Socrates is more or less redeeming the trickery of Athens into something different. He's saying, like, I have the very best form of trickery, and get this, it isn't trickery at all. It's the study of wisdom. And everyone else is like, no, that's not reason. Reason is when, you know, you can make yourself right before other people. It's not when you have, like, the best argument or the simplest argument should never be the best argument. It's the most eloquent one. That's what the sophists believed. But Socrates proves them wrong, that the simplest argument can be the best argument. And so there's this part of philosophy that I think is really important, that it shook up the culture of Athens and fundamentally changed it forever. Socrates inspired so many people that Plato had enough people to make an academy with. And then that, of course, became so famous that Aristotle became a student there. And none of those things had to happen. Nothing in history is forced to happen. It happens because people choose to let it happen. And, you know, you could argue that there are some fundamental laws of human behavior, that humans generally tend to behave like this and tend to behave like that. But you have to think about it for a moment and just appreciate that it's very possible that we could live in a world where Socrates either never existed or we never knew about him because no one ever wrote anything down. And the fact that he had a gifted disciple who was a former playwright and knew how to write things down for stage production value is, well, we can be very grateful that was in fact a fact of history, because that gave us philosophy as we know it. Going into a little bit more of the ideas, because that is what we're supposed to do on the Canadian Philosophy Show, I am very interested to think a little bit about the difference between Aristotle's method of categories versus Plato's method of forms.
Of what I've studied of Aristotle, I have mostly read his Nicomachean Ethics. I've nosed through the physics a little bit and a little bit of the metaphysics, but I'm not, I don't know that much about the categories.
We can also leave that to the next show if we want to talk more about the
form. Yeah, let's do that, and then I'm happy to take up that mantle next time around.
Okay.
Right. So let's talk about Socrates and
Plato's theory of the forms. Let's do that. That's very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But since let's let Brandon go first, because I could talk about this for a while.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm trying to remember specifically, because I know you were, we were in a class where we learned about Plato's theory of forms. I'm trying to remember specifically, I mean, where do I start? Okay, so basically, if we're taking I mean, let's get down to the level of a text a little bit. That's where I'm used to starting. We should note that nowhere does Plato himself come out and say, I have this theory of forms. Here's what I believe, et cetera, et cetera. It's one theory of forms does get articulated. That's what you get at the end of the day, but it's kind of smuggled in there in a way, I guess. Yeah, it's kind of scattered throughout. But essentially, what the theory of forms is it is an attempt to explain what something is, and it is a two-world theory. So there is the world of what is perceptible, what we perceive, the world we live in. So, for example, I'm holding a cup. That's one world. There's another world. There's the world of what is intelligible. And that world is occupied by forms, eternal beings, you know, objects, I guess, that are completely intelligible, that have existed for all time. And those two worlds have a relation to each other. Now, the nature of that relation is quite vague, even in the text and even in the scholarship. But the word that often gets used is participation, that our world, the world of perception, participates in the world of the eternal world, the world of the intelligible things. What Plato wants to argue through his text is that insofar as you grasp, so I'm holding a cup, insofar as I grasp what the cup is, I go beyond understanding this particular cup and I understand the form of the cup. I grasp something intelligible. What's important is I grasp something other than what's right in front of me. It is a theory of understanding the world purely intelligibly. It is not one of an aesthetic appreciation. Well, there might be a certain aesthetic appreciation to forms, but it's not one where we contemplate exactly what is in front of us. It's us addressing what is mentally and rationally intelligible. And ultimately, that is, so it's a two-world theory. It's not, but those two worlds are not completely equal for Plato. One of those worlds has a higher ontological status. And what that means is that one of those is real and the other is less real. It exists, obviously. Like, don't worry, you're still in the world. But it's like this is ultimately, if listeners are probably familiar with the allegory of the cave, our world is the shadows. The intelligible world that is really real is beyond where one grasps what is really there. So your world still exists. You're still seeing stuff, sure. But what you really understand when you understand and what you ought to understand is other than what you live in. It is other than the world that you live in. Hopefully
that is a profound idea. I mean, like, I know it's like us philosophers just patting ourselves on the back and being like, well done. But in all seriousness, if we didn't have that type of conception, it'd be really hard to say that something like mathematics actually exists. Because what type of thing is mathematics? It isn't a physical thing. It's not something you perceive. It's something that is intelligible and exists somewhere else. And so you could say that, like, all mathematicians have to be Platonists. That's definitely not the case, as there are other ways of conceptualizing and framing knowledge. But it's really, I would say, amazing that we have an idea like that, like the theory of forms, and we can do so much with it.
And just to fill in some gaps, I mean, Brandon articulated the theory itself wonderfully, and I think that was a good explanation. I think it's important to understand the context, as Aaron's been talking about, the historical context that gives rise to this theory. That Plato, I wrote this down, Socrates espoused it, perhaps, that Socrates would have been influenced most likely by a school of ancient Greek mysticism that aspired to the idea that all souls prior to being born into physical bodies, physical forms, if you will, were goddesses that were exiled from wherever, Olympus, I guess, or wherever, right? So there's this idea that in your physicality, you are limited. So when Brandon talks about the gripping of the glass and seeing the glass, or in my case, holding up a book, I can only understand the book so far as I understand what I've perceived, and I can extrapolate a more intellectual understanding of, well, a book is a collection of writings, and a collection of writings is a collection of ideas that came out of someone's head, which then we wrote down on parchment, right? But I can't fully understand what a book in its truest form is because I am limited by my physical experience. This is why when you read something like the Phaedo that we've talked about, Socrates actually finds great hope in death, because Socrates himself defines the practice of philosophy as practicing for death. Why? That sounds a little morbid. Tegan, you're ending the show on a morbid note. I'm not, in Socrates' estimation, because in practicing philosophy and understanding that difference, in understanding what wisdom is, in understanding what we are and how we relate to that physical and non-physical world, the world of forms and the world of particulars, particulars being the physical manifestation or representation of a form, that is where we are actually free, because we come from the land of the forms anyway. So Socrates actually says on the day of his execution, while he's awaiting, he says, "Tell my friend to join me quickly so that we can be reunited where we belong." Right? So there's this very profound metaphysical side of this. It's not just let's intellectualize everything, but it's actually fits back to Socrates' whole mission of, I don't know everything. Why? Because I'm stuck in physical form anyway. When I transcend this form and go back to where I belong, then I'll know all I need to know.
Yeah, that's definitely a scary thing for us modern people to consider. I would say it would offend most people's sensibilities, the idea that it's really just a very religious notion from that context. It's a little strange to think about the fact that while that was perhaps the original inspiration for the theory of the forms, we don't take that, when we use that idea, that philosophical idea today, we don't necessarily bring that baggage into our discussions. We don't say that, like, to use the idea of the forms, you have to believe that you came from some land of gods and goddesses, and that, you know, you're limited by your physical body. We don't say it in those terms today. It's really difficult to talk about science or the philosophy of science without using language and words, which, well, language is words, But by creating new mechanisms and processes to explain information, usually in science that means creating new vocabulary and conducting many experiments and creating mathematical equations, which are then explained by very lengthy, very long textbooks and scientific papers that investigate these things and propose mechanisms in language and in words. And you might say, Aaron, well, what does this have to do with the theory of forms? When we do a lot of modern science, the pinnacle of modern science is to discover what we call scientific laws, which are what we consider to be eternal principles that govern the physical world. That's somewhat debatable in terms of what a scientific law is and should be, and there's a whole set of philosophy of science dedicated to what specifically we should mean in terms of a scientific law. I'm raising this here because I want our listeners to understand that the theory of forms more or less is one of the things that inspires the modern notion of scientific law, that our understandings of things are related to each other because everyone in humanity shares the same planet, at least as far as we know. So, and that means a lot of things that aren't easy to understand, which is kind of the joy of studying history and of studying philosophy.
Basically, the understanding of Western philosophy is no small task, because there's so many great minds that have looked at this and contributed that we have only begun to scratch the surface. And I'm pleased with the work we've done here tonight. And I hope this encourages our listeners to spend some time looking at some of these people, even in synopsis form, to understand just the impact that these ideas have had on Western cultures, thinking and processing of information. Because, as Aaron said, there's so much philosophy that we may not realize has crept into other areas of our life and investigative tendencies.
Thank you so much to our listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I have been your host, Aaron Wang, and I've been joined by my co-hosts, Tegan Marshall and Brandon Brownlee.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Vancouver Art Gallery presents the Vancouver-based artist Mary Corey's most recent work, I Love, in the gallery's first floor rotunda until November 19, 2023. Paying homage to the calligraphic nature of Arabic in her work, Corey draws inspiration from Henry Moore's sensuous sculptures and Zaha Hadid's organic architectural structures. To learn more about this exhibition, visit vanartgallery.bc.ca.